Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to another Hindu Studies Channel podcast of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my academic background at rajbalkaran.com/academia. More importantly, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Antonia Ruckel of Oxford University. She's in the Department of Linguistics, Philology, and Phonetics, and we are going to dive into her brand new Sanskrit grammar book. Hello, Antonia. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Raj. Thank you for having me.
All right. So this is different than most of our new books, which are related to a specific area of study, whether it's a ethnographic study or a literary study. This is a book that helps people learn a language. Mm-hmm. And as will be made clear by the end of this interview, it is nonetheless, if not more so exciting than the typical books we use, because it's not every day that we unearth a brand new Sanskrit reader. It must have been quite the enterprise for you.
Yes, it did take me about 10 years to complete it, sort of to bring it from the original idea to it actually being published.
Wow. Could you tell us a little bit about that process? I gather from your intro teaching Sanskrit and your students were also a large part of the process. But could you tell our listeners a little bit about what goes into the process of birthing a Sanskrit grammar book?
Yes, of course. So what happened was that in 2005, I got a job as a language lecturer at Cornell University in the US. And I was teaching Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit, and I was rather happy with the Latin and Greek books that I had available for my classes. But with Sanskrit, I just found myself making more and more supplementary materials, things that would answer the questions that my students had. I also found that my classes were very diverse. There were people with many different backgrounds, many different interests. I had classicists, I had linguists, I had people whose families originally came from India of, you know, various academic backgrounds. So physicists, engineers, I had historians, I had anthropologists. And so the books that I had or that I knew of at the time, they all addressed some of the questions that my students were asking or some of the interests that my students had. And so I was just making more and more things myself. And I mentioned this to someone that I knew from my time at Cambridge who was working for Cambridge University Press. And he said, oh, I think the religious studies editor has been looking for someone to write a Sanskrit textbook for us. Would you be interested in putting your materials together and actually, you know, completing them so that a complete full textbook would result? And I said, yes, absolutely. And that process just sort of took a little longer. Getting it approved with CUP, getting a contract from CUP, that was rather an involved thing. But what I did, so on the Sanskrit side of things, basically I tried to make sure that all Sanskrit grammar that you need to know if you want to start reading Sanskrit texts, that was contained in the book in a way that was accessible to someone who did not have any prior knowledge of language learning, of linguistics, of the methods of how to learn an ancient language. So many 19th century Sanskrit textbooks, which are still in use, they very often assume that students know Latin and Greek already, and so they know how to approach an ancient language. And with 21st century students, that's just not the case. So I try to make sure that all the little prompters, all the little bits of background that you need to learn a language as joyfully as possible were included in the book. And my own personal background is as a comparative linguist. So I try to make sure that whenever knowledge of the history of the Sanskrit language or of comparative philology came in useful, that I'd include that in the book so that students could profit from that and could understand what was going on with irregular forms, things that looked difficult and so on, could understand that rather than having to just memorize it.
No, it certainly strikes me as both comprehensive and an accessible, well-organized, well-laid-out Sanskrit reader. And
thank you. That's what my goal was.
Well, it's no small feat. So just to give our listeners a touch of background, I started Sanskrit study in 2005. We used a book that was I had a teacher at the University of Toronto. We were in a class, a course at the time. The book was actually a teach yourself book, Sanskrit book by Michael Coulson.
Michael Coulson, yes.
And over the years, both for my personal study, also for students that wish to learn Sanskrit, whether private or whether in an academic context, I'll use bits from Coulson. I'll use bits from Deshpande. Mm-hmm. I use bits from Robert Goldman's textbook, and there really isn't a go-to for me anyhow. And really, this came on my radar for the purposes of this interview. And I really am immediately considering making this text my go-to text because it's so well laid out.
I'm so pleased to hear that.
So a couple of questions that, you know, we've internalized this, but yes. Let me ask you, this is a Hindu studies podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm a Hindu studies scholar and I learned Sanskrit because the work that I looked at was a Sanskrit text, which is probably obvious to our readers. Why is knowledge of or study of Sanskrit crucial for Hindu studies? What is Sanskrit? Where does Sanskrit fit in this ancient language?
Yes, well, for religion or for any other tradition, there are basically two ways of passing on knowledge of beliefs, of rituals, of traditions, and so on, from one generation to the next. One is oral, so you would learn from your parents or from your grandparents how things are done, basically. But if you want to get in touch directly with how, you know, what people believed, what people thought was important longer ago, then you have to read texts. And the oldest texts that we have, the oldest Hindu texts that we have, are all written in Sanskrit. And of course, there are translations available. You can read, for example, the Bhagavad Gita. There are, you know, numerous translations that you can read. But I've always found that when you read a text that isn't just meant to be a sort of dry instruction manual, but that is meant to be literature, so that is meant to have a certain shape, a certain form, as well as a certain contents, it's always so much more, first of all, enjoyable to read it in the original yourself, because you can see not just what someone said, but how they said it. But also very often there are little uncertainties or little tricky passages in most texts where a translator often will be tempted to choose one translation that is clearer than the original, that makes sense to them. They will choose the translation that they think is the right one. Whereas when you look at the original text, you can see that there is an uncertainty, that there is room for interpretation and so on. And if you are able to read these texts in the original, then you can see exactly where ideas are coming from, where teachings are coming from, but also where differences in traditions come from. Because, you know, we could talk about, especially in the West, we talk about Hinduism as though it were this unified phenomenon. But no, you know, it's a huge variety of traditions, of beliefs. And it's interesting to see where certain differences come from. And if you can access those original texts, then you can see for yourself why people interpret different texts differently, for example.
So much in the way, to use a crude analogy, that Latin was the linguistic currency of the early days of the church, for example. Sanskrit is
in Europe. Yeah.
Right. In Europe, Sanskrit is this ancient language in which ritual is performed, in which philosophy, narrative, theology is written. And so Sanskrit really is the linguistic world of the foundations of what we call Hinduism.
Yes, exactly.
Great.
Yeah, the foundations of Hinduism. Later texts, of course, are written, are composed in many of the more recent languages of India, but the oldest texts, those would have been composed in Sanskrit, yes.
So really those who would be interested in Sanskrit, learning Sanskrit, are really those who would be interested in all things Indic, it seems, in an
yes.
effort to deepen one's knowledge, whether it's learning about history, you know, whether you're looking at a culinary text or a ritual text or a narrative text or any sort of Indian thought, practice, culture is more often than not tied to the Sanskrit speaking world. And the Sanskrit speaking world, now there's so many questions I have that are going to interest, I think, our listeners, but mm-hmm. could you comment on this idea of the Sanskrit, quote unquote, Sanskrit speaking world, where, if anywhere, is Sanskrit spoken? Was it ever, do you think, a mother tongue? Could you unpack that a bit for us?
Yeah, well, that's an intricate question, and I'm probably not going to be able to give a sort of fully satisfying answer, but I'll try my best. There are basically two languages that we ought to look at, which are closely linked. One we call Sanskrit, and the other one we call Vedic. Some people call it Vedic Sanskrit, but Vedic is I think, the better name for it. And the thing is that we have these texts called the Vedas, after which the name Vedic was chosen. And these texts are very old. They date back to probably the second millennium BC. And they were ritual texts. They were hymns that would be sung, that would be performed during the rituals of the Vedic religion, of the pre-Hindu religion, of what we find in especially northern India at that time. And these texts were extremely important for ritual practice for a very long time, for many centuries. But given that all languages change, given that spoken languages change, so for example, if you read an English text that's 200 years ago, there will be, you know, words you don't understand, constructions you don't understand, and so on. So because spoken languages change, people needed to make sure that these ancient texts that were still important for their daily ritual life remained intelligible. And so a grammarian tradition arose. Grammarians are people who try to write down the rules of a language. You know, how do you form plurals? How do you use this particular verb? How do you use a particular case, which is a one form in which nouns can appear? So they collected these rules, and this grammarian tradition was very important, was very well looked after. And at some point, we have someone who brought this tradition to a kind of culmination. His name is Panini. We assume that he lived in around the 5th century BC, and we think he lived somewhere in northern India. We're not exactly sure where. But basically, his grammar, so his list of rules of the Sanskrit language, became seen as authoritative. Which had the result that not only was it used to help people understand earlier texts, but anyone who spoke or wrote in Sanskrit at that point used Panini's rules. So from around the 5th century BC, this language, which was called Sanskrit, which basically means perfected or completed are probably the best translations here. So this language, Sanskrit, from the 5th century BC onwards, did not change at all anymore. And so all texts written in it since are basically intelligible to someone who learns these 5th century BC rules. So before Sanskrit came in, Vedic, we assume, would have been spoken at a time. But these Vedic hymns, they are very artful, they are polished, they are beautiful, they are literature. And even though that language would presumably have been spoken, it's a little bit like if you read 20th or 21st century English literature, very often that will be, or especially if you read poetry, that language in a way is being spoken, but it's probably not being spoken in as polished, as thought through, in as artful a way. Yeah. So Vedic would have been spoken, but in a much more, you know, everyday fashion. Many words would have been used that are not needed in the ceremonial kind of context from which these hymns come. So many words that people would have used back then, for all sorts of everyday things, just don't survive. So a form of that language from the Vedic hymns, we assume, would have been spoken. Now, when it comes to Sanskrit, that was the language of literature, scholarship, also to a certain extent, from some point on, not necessarily administration, but some sort of higher up official texts. To what extent it was spoken is we are not certain of, but given how well people wrote in it, given how artfully, how beautifully, how fluently people wrote Sanskrit, it seems very likely that these people would also be able to have educated conversations in Sanskrit. So my personal assumption is that, yes, these people would have been able to speak Sanskrit, at least with other, you know, equally educated, equally literarily active friends or acquaintances.
Thank you for that comprehensive response. There are a couple of themes in what you said, a couple aspects of the language that I would like to draw out for the sake of our listeners. Mm-hmm. Something that Antonia mentioned is that Sanskrit, the word Sanskrit is an anglicization of an actual Sanskrit word, mm-hmm. Samskrita, so well-made, refined, polished. Mm-hmm. And that is quite an apt description for the language because it is both very beautiful acoustically, and it from the moment that I learned the alphabet and onwards, it is extraordinarily organized. It is an insanely organized language. I mean, you know, I don't know many other languages. French, a bit of German, English, obviously, there was obviously a great deal of emphasis on structure and the production of sound with Sanskrit. Would you agree?
Yes, I would say that the ancient grammarians who I mentioned earlier, for them, it was very important to have things very, very neatly arranged. And Sanskrit is you know, highly suited for that. So the sounds that we have in Sanskrit can be very systematically arranged, are very systematic. But for example, the system of sounds. So when you you start with the vowels, first the simple vowels, then the more complex vowels, and so on. But when you go through this, the a e e u u r l, then actually the long vocalic L sound, so the l sound, that doesn't actually occur in Sanskrit, but it was added by grammarians to this list so that you arrive at a list that is complete, that is balanced, that is systematic, and so on. And actually having it there, having it in that list when you learn Sanskrit, it makes it a lot easier if you can just learn something regular rather than memorize regular bits and, oh yeah, then there's this one irregular little hole in it. So short answer would be, yes, there is Sanskrit is a very systematic language. However, that is the case with many languages, and the systematic sort of perfected or polished character of Sanskrit comes out particularly clearly in or through the Sanskrit grammarian tradition, where systematizing is very important, but for many, you know, pedagogically very sound reasons, I find.
So Sanskrit will have some, I'll assume that most of our listeners are native English speakers and perhaps primarily or only speak English. Mm-hmm. Sanskrit will have some features that would be new to English speakers. Could you maybe unpack, because you lay them out systematically in your book, but there are issues of number, gender, declensions. Maybe say a bit about the features of Sanskrit that it's not quite the case where one translates from an English sentence into a Sanskrit construction the way one might in a modern language like Italian or even German or French. Mm-hmm. There's a very different way in which the language is constructed, and maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Yes, happily. This is one of the many things that I find beautiful about Sanskrit. So in English, if I want to express some kind of an idea about an action, such as, you know, I go, then the fact that it is me, that it is I who's doing the going, is expressed in a separate word. I, expressing the me who's doing the going, and go, expressing what kind of action I'm doing. If I want to say that I'm not doing this right now, but I will do it tomorrow, then I would say something like, I will go. So each of these aspects of who is doing something, when are they doing it, would be expressed with a separate word. I will go, you will go, he will go, I have gone, and so on. Now, in Sanskrit, what you typically do with almost all forms is that you have a what we call a verbal root, which is a minimal entity, which is the minimal, formally minimal bit that expresses an action, doing, going, seeing, eating, laughing, and so on. And to that, you then add things in front of the root, into the root, and behind the root to express an idea that in English or also many other modern languages would be expressed with or by means of several words. So the root for to go is gam. Now the way of expressing that I am doing something is the ending ani. And if I want to express that I'm not doing it right now, but I'll be doing it in the future, then what I need to do is add a little bit in between the root and the ending, and that is the form ishya in this case. So gamishyami would then be the equivalent, that's one word, would be the equivalent to English, I will go. And you have the same thing with nouns. So in English, if I want to express what function a noun is playing in a sentence, so for example, I'm cutting the cake with a knife, I clean the knife, this is a sheath for the knife, then what I do is I always add this little preposition before in front of the noun, so for the knife, with the knife, from the knife, and so on. Or sometimes I don't add a preposition at all, I just put the knife in a particular sentence, sorry, a particular position in the sentence. So for example, the knife cuts the cake, for example, the knife stands before the verb and that indicates it's the subject. I see the knife comes behind the verb, that indicates it's the object. So not the thing that's doing something, but that has something done to it. And in Sanskrit, what you do for all of these, rather than having position being the crucially important factor or prepositions being important, you just add a set of endings. So a knife would be shastram, and if you do something by means of a knife, it would be shastrena. If you are cleaning crumbs off the knife, away from the knife, that would be shastrat, and so on. And this adding endings and suffixes and prefixes and infixes, so adding things behind and front and into a stem or a root, is what we call synthetic. And there are a number of ancient languages, especially ancient Indo-European languages, that are synthetic. Sanskrit is one of them. And I personally just find that, I don't know, I find it beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful both in terms of organization and in terms of the way it sounds, isn't it?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
It's quite beautiful. So just randomly, like the language, why it's called Sanskrit or purified or refined is that the language is set up such that only certain sounds can come in contact with certain sounds. This is the rules of elision, so that it sounds beautiful. And there's just so much Sanskrit, but just to give the listeners a sense, here's the beginning of the Sri Suktam. It's a hymn to the feminine divine in the form of Sri, like abundance, prosperity. And if I remember right, it goes something like Hiranyavaranam Harinim Suvarna Rajatashtrajam Chandram Hiranmayim Lakshmim Jata Vedam Mava. It has this flow that isn't quite there in modern languages, is it?
I would say that, you know, the beauty of each language is different. And Sanskrit has a very intricate and very ancient tradition of chanting texts that makes them extremely beautiful to listen to, yes. I'm always a little hesitant when it comes to saying, you know, one language is better than another language in a certain way, because if you listen to, so for example, my own native tongue, German, supposedly is so, you know, guttural and rough and awful and whatnot. But when I listen to German poetry or when I listen to a German play being performed, I don't necessarily find that. I find that it's quite different from listening to someone perform Sanskrit poetry or Sanskrit hymns. But the question of, you know, what is better, I'm always very hesitant to answer, because there are so many different forms of beauty.
That is a wonderful perspective, to note that various languages have features that are unique to them and beautiful.
Yes,
in whatever they accomplish.
And one feature of that I very much like concerning Sanskrit is that Sanskrit not only, you know, composes its individual word forms, so its individual verbs, its individual nouns, and so on, with all these affixes. But Sanskrit has this feature called compounding, which other languages have as well, but Sanskrit has made it into an art form. So an example of a compound in English would be toothbrush, you know, which is a brush for your teeth, or a treehouse, which is a house in a tree. There's lots of examples that you can give, but in Sanskrit, you can form compounds that express whole little stories, basically. I think one example that you might also know from Coulson's textbook, he describes how to build up compounds, larger compounds from smaller compounds. And the one example that he gives is completely cool from the recent evening bath. And he's absolutely right. That is something that in Sanskrit you can express as one word. And that is something where Sanskrit truly does excel and is much more intricate. And you could even say, you know, better than most other languages.
And it's part of the reason why you may see a verse, for example, if you're, whether you're studying it or not, maybe you are looking at the Bhagavad Gita in English, and the edition has the Sanskrit verse, and you're thinking to yourself, my goodness, there are these two squiggly lines in Sanskrit. How come there's like eight lines of English text? And part of that is because the language is it's so compactable in that you have endings to indicate all kinds of things, and you can compound them in ways. Would you agree? It's much more compact, language.
Yes. Well, I think it's a phenomenon that translators have found across languages, that the language into which you translate something always turns out to be a little longer than the original language. Because if the original language was written by someone who knew how to use this language, how to play with this language, then they will have it in a form that is I don't want to say compact, that sounds so utilitarian, that will be concise, that will be economical, that will not waste anything, and still at the same time, they will be expressing the exact idea that they're trying to express. And then if you try and translate this, you are necessarily dealing with longer sentences, slightly longer phrasings, if you want to bring across the exact same contents, the exact same ideas. That's something that I think is the case across all languages, but you are absolutely right. It is the case even more so with a language such as Sanskrit, where so much information can be packed up into just one, either into one compound or just one verb form and so on. Yes. And the nice thing, if you know Sanskrit, is then that you can see exactly with each verse, with each line, how one Sanskrit word then unfolds into a whole phrase or maybe even a whole clause in English.
So you told us about case endings. Could you tell us about, for those who may be thinking of diving into the ocean of Sanskrit and some of the features they might see there, can you say a little bit about the numbers and the genders and sandhi, elision?
Yes. So I'll start with the numbers and the genders. So number, when you use that as a linguistic or as a kind of technical term, means a form that expresses how many of something you're talking about. In English, we've got two grammatical numbers, that's singular and plural. So for example, I can talk about one cat, but as soon as there is more than one cat, I would talk about two cats, or one dog, two dogs, one king, two kings, and so on. In Sanskrit, there is a third number, and that is the so-called dual, spelled D-U-A-L, so not to do with D-U-E-L, with dueling, with fighting. So the dual, which talks about exactly two. So I would have a form for one man, that would be Narah. I would have one form for two men, that's Narau. And then I would have a form for more than two men, so that would in English would be, which in English would be the plural, which would be Narah. And every noun has a full set of forms for just one, exactly two, and more than two. And every verb has a set of forms for I do this, you do this, he, she, it does it in the singular. The two of us, the two of you, the two of them do it in the dual. And we, you, they in the plural. So this idea, this category of exactly two, is expressed very, very precisely in each noun form or in each verb form. So that was the category of number. Now the other category that you just asked about was, sorry.
I'll just say one quick comment. When we first started learning Sanskrit, it was like, wow, we have to learn a singular, a plural, and a dual. And it occurred to me that the dual is so very convenient. In the human experience, when it comes to two things in particular, body parts, it's so intuitive to say for a word to have two hands, two eyes, two feet, and also relationships. Like
exactly
when you say this, oftentimes there'll be two people, whether they're parent and child, or teacher, disciple, or lovers, like they two or we two. And it's convenient when it comes to relationships and body parts in terms of understanding why why a culture would come up for a specific case for just two things, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It is extremely convenient. It is confusing for people who are not used to it. But that should never be a category. That's a category for language learners. If you're not used to something from your own language, then it's more difficult to remember using it when you are using that other language. But I found exactly what you just described, that it comes in very handy on all sorts of occasions. And I once took an intensive course in spoken Sanskrit one summer several years ago, and day the homework that we were set was to retell a story that we liked in Sanskrit. And there is a story that's written by a German author about a pair of twins who didn't know that they were twins until they meet at a summer camp. There's various American movies based on that story, but I decided to retell that story because I very much liked it. And I also thought, this is going to give me really good exercise on the duel, because two girls then do all sorts of things together. And it was funny because I knew that this was what I was doing. I had set myself this task. I am going to write about these two exactly so that I can practice my duel. But so very often I would remember to put the noun into the duel, but then use a plural verb, because in my mind, German is exactly the same as English. We have a singular and we have a plural. In my mind, as soon as I talk about more than one person doing something, I automatically use the plural. So Sanskrit is has an extra nuance of preciseness there. One, exactly two, or more than two.
And it also has another degree of preciseness when it comes to gender, doesn't it?
Yes. Oh, gender was the other question. Yes, indeed. So if you start from on the basis of English, gender is basically something that we only really have in pronouns. So pronouns are words like he, she, or it, or that, or they. And in English, if I refer to anyone who is alive and considered a male, or a man, whether that's an adult or a boy, or also a male animal, then we would refer to them as he. Same if they're alive, but they're female, then we would refer to them as she. And anything else is referred to as it. And so that we automatically make this choice that, if I see a house, I know I refer to it as it because it's not alive. I see a person, I refer to them as he or she because I know they're alive. This is us having internalized the rules of grammatical gender as they apply to English. Now, in Sanskrit, you have the same thing. So whenever I refer to a noun, I have to choose between a masculine, a feminine, and a neuter pronoun. So masculine is he. Feminine is she, neuter is it. Except that in Sanskrit, you can tell just by looking at a word what gender it is. Very often, the ending, the last couple of letters of the word will tell you what gender it is. And even if that isn't the case with some nouns, then any adjective that describes a noun will have to take on the form that is right for the gender of that noun. So for example, a house in Sanskrit, graham is neuter. And so if I want to describe a beautiful house, then I would say sundaram graham. But if I wanted to describe a tree, vriksha, which is masculine, then I couldn't say sundaram vrikshach, I would have to say sundarach vrikshach. So in the form of the adjective, I have to indicate that it is masculine so that I can use it together with a masculine noun. So the system is very similar in its foundations to what we have in English, but once more, it's a lot more intricate. And for the language learner, at first it is extra work, because you need to memorize what gender is this word. But if you are reading a text, then it's actually going to be very helpful very soon, because if you see a feminine adjective, you know that this can only be describing a feminine noun. And if you're not quite sure which noun it is describing, you just look for the noun that has the same gender and otherwise also the same ending or the same case and the same gender as this adjective, and you'll know which adjective to translate with which noun.
Lovely. Now, the third thing that I'd asked about, that if you can share with us, is...
Sandhi, yes.
Sandhi. Maybe just give a taste of what Sandhi is and how it functions. And mm-hmm. My sense is that it goes a long way towards preserving both the acoustic beauty of the language and the ease mm-hmm. on the tongue. But I'm happy to learn what you think is going on with Sandhi.
Well, so Sandhi literally means putting together. The D comes from a root dha, which means to put, and sam just means together. And samdhi becomes sandhi because an N is easier to pronounce in front of a dha. They're both pronounced with your tongue against your teeth. Then samdhi would be pronounced. Then would be to pronounce samdhi. So the word sandhi is already a case or an instance of this phenomenon, sandhi. And sandhi is the term that is used to express the changes in pronunciation that occur when two sounds meet. So that can be at the end of a word and the beginning of the next word, or that can be within words. So I was talking about how you may have to add an ending or something in front of a root, or you may even have to add something into a root. So when that happens, new sounds meet, and to make them fluidly pronounceable, their pronunciation often changes. And the way in which it changes is that things usually become more similar to each other. So, for example, in English, we do have instances of sandhi, but they're nowhere near as systematic as those that we find in So they're nowhere near as systematic as what we find in Sanskrit. So, for example, if you talk about a handbag, so a bag that you hold in your hand, so a bag of a certain size and certain format, that will very rarely be pronounced handbag. Usually it's much more something like handbag. And what happened here was that the nd of the hand in front of the b of bag didn't stay as a nd, so the sound pronounced with the tongue against your teeth, nd, changed to something that was more similar to the following sound. So what followed was a b, which you pronounce with your lips pushed together. And so instead of having a nd, we now get a m. So we get a handbag. So a m is pronounced with your lips, a b is pronounced with your lips, and this is a lot easier to pronounce than a handbag. Or this also happens with the sound N very frequently. In English, we have this, you know, this letter N that actually represents all sorts of different sounds. If I use the word N in the verb to send, so to send a letter, for example, then what the N represents, the letter N represents, is a sound that is pronounced with your tongue against your teeth. It's send. And that's because the d that follows after this n is a sound that is also pronounced with your tongue against your teeth. So send, nd, is very easy to pronounce. However, if I have a verb such as sing, then we still spell that with the letter n, but the letter n doesn't actually represent the sound n, the dental tongue against your teeth sound, but it's sing, so it's a n sound. And this n sound is a lot easier to pronounce in front of the g that comes at the end of the verb sing. And so what we've got here is what in Sanskrit terms you would call internal sandhi. So sounds changing their pronunciation so that they roll off the tongue more easily. Now in English, we have this phenomenon, as I just tried to show, but we don't really represent it in writing. You know, I use this letter N to represent a variety of sounds. In Sanskrit, they are very much aware of how things are pronounced and how pronunciation changes when sounds meet, and they represent that in writing. So for example, in Sanskrit, you would represent the sound N with one letter, but you would represent the sound m, as in sing, with a completely different letter, because it's a completely different sound. And sandhi is something that is represented in Sanskrit in a completely systematic way, which means that we know exactly how things are pronounced, but it also means that it's it makes texts a little more difficult to read, because if you have one word such as narah, meaning man, and this ach sound at the end of the word is changed depending on what sound follows, what the next word is, then all of a sudden you're not just dealing with one word, man, anymore, but you're dealing with five or six different looking words that underlyingly all are the same. So while sandhi is wonderful for teaching us about the pronunciation of words and preserving sounds, ancient sounds, For the reader, it can present, especially for the beginning reader, it can present quite the challenge.
And so, because of these various moving parts of case endings and genders and numbers and elision, it is vital to have a text that lays the various layers out in a systematic and digestible way. So. Mm-hmm. So I encourage the listener to not be intimidated if learning Sanskrit is something that calls to you. It's the payoff is huge in terms of access to worlds within worlds of ideas, of invocations, of poetry. So there's a vast array of material that one can access.
Beauty, poetry, wisdom, there's so much. If I could just go back very briefly to what you just said, were exactly right when you said that, it's very important that if you want to learn all this information, and yes, Sanskrit is intricate to learn, it's extremely important to have things, clearly laid out, to have clear tables and so on. And that's exactly why what I tried to do in my book. I tried to make the things that you cannot understand, but where you need to memorize, I try to make them as visually appealing and visually not impressive, but to sort of try to make them such that they leave an impression on the visual part of your brain. Just trying to make them as easy as possible to remember, to memorize, simply because, yes, there's quite a few of them. That is the main difficulty in learning Sanskrit, that there are so many different little forms to memorize. And so what a Sanskrit textbook needs to do is be aware of that, and then be aware of all the pedagogical techniques that are at our disposal to make this memorization as pain-free as possible.
So tell us a bit about the pedagogical approach, or the way in which the book is set up, and to teach the reader, to have the reader learn with the teacher. Maybe mention the fact that it's not just a book, one has access to online resources.
Yes. So as I said, a big thing for me is trying to make a memorization as easy as possible, or more realistically put, as pain-free as possible. So just going back to sandhi very briefly, whenever I introduce sandhi in any of the classes that I teach, if I do not have any students going pale or, starting to look slightly tearful, then I see this as a successful lesson. Sandhi is something that overwhelms pretty much everyone. I have yet to meet a student who just goes, oh yeah, that's a piece of cake. Ideally, after a couple of lessons, I will have them understand the principle behind at least some sandhi changes, and then they will go, oh, well, obviously it's that and that. But it always takes at least a couple of lessons. So I learned Sanskrit through self-study. I learned it using the book that you mentioned earlier, called Since Teach Yourself Sanskrit. And while I had someone who I could from time to time turn to when it came to questions, bits that I didn't understand in the book, most of my Sanskrit studies were basically just me trying to figure out the book. And I just found that there were some things in there that were very good, and other things where the information was presented on the page, but in such a way that it was really, really difficult to take in. So what I tried to do very systematically in my book was whenever there is something that needs to be memorized, it will be in a clearly laid out table. The layout won't change from one table to the next, so that you know the amount of extraneous information you have to take in is minimal. There will be lots of space around it for your own notes. I always encourage my students to do, you know, whatever works for them to memorize. So whether they want to color code things, whether they want to, you know, write things in different fonts. So for example, all the singular forms, if you want to have them in a Times New Roman, in the dual forms in, I don't know, Helvetica or some completely different font, anything that works for you, anything that allows you to remember things more easily is fair game as far as I'm concerned. And so to a certain extent, you can do that in a book that's to be used by many different people. And so the clear layout, the formatting was something that I found was very, very important throughout. And also I know from my own experience that it's important to be able to have one place where you can look up all information that you're vaguely familiar with, that you know you should know, but that you've already forgotten because it was from 3 weeks ago or something. So I've put a detailed reference grammar in the back, where basically all the forms, all the tables are neatly laid out in one place where you can find them easily whenever you're reading a text. Now, so that's just for the visual part of it. The other thing that I tried to do as best I could was explain whatever is going on, rather than just give people the forms and say, okay, you know, here, learn them. With vocabulary, very often the only thing that you can do is give people the words to learn and ask them to learn them. You can encourage them to say, you know, if something reminds you of something else, if something sounds similar to something else, you can use that to help you remember that particular word. But that's not something very systematic. When I was teaching at a secondary school, my youngest students were 11 and 12, and they came up with the best mnemonics. So, for example, in Sanskrit, there's a word churnam, meaning grass. And in London, close to where I was teaching, there was a underground stop called Turnham Green. And because Turnham is green, you can remember that Turnham means grass. So I try to encourage these things for vocabulary, but the big thing that I try to do is encourage understanding the systems behind all the grammatical parts. So behind especially things like the sandhi, or things that you add to roots in order to form particular words and so on. But sorry, I think I just interrupted you. You sounded as though you were about to say something.
No, it's fine. I was going to comment on how clever the
device turn of was. Green.
Yes, yes. And also, would you say that this text is ideally suited for self-study, study with a teacher, or equally both?
I'm hoping that it is useful for both. And I've had lots of reports from people who used it on their own or also in classrooms who seemed to think that it worked, you know, for either setup. What I did so that it becomes useful for self-study is I've added lots and lots of additional material. So the book has a website, cambridge-sanskrit.org, where I basically have links to all the online resources, various things to download. So the handouts for learning how to write using the Devanagari script, the reference grammar from the back of the book, so that you don't always have to leaf back and forth and back and forth in the book. You can just, you know, get it from the website, print it out, and have it next to you. It has links to all the online flashcards that I've put up. I find that memorizing things where there is no real system, where you just have to memorize lots of different individual entities, I can do that best if I don't have these forms on a page, but on individual flashcards. I used to make these just on paper or sort of cardboard flashcards, but now we've got all these online programs available where you can put each form that is to be memorized on a card. On the back of the of this electronic card, you put the answer, you put the identification, and then the computer guides you and remembers which forms you got right, which forms you didn't get right. So the computer, the program will quiz you. You don't need help from anyone else. You can do it all on your own, which is very handy, I think. I use these a lot. And then the other thing that I've done is the main difference between learning something yourself and learning it with a teacher is, of course, that, you know, the teacher is there to present new material, is there to introduce new material to you. And when you just read something in a book, sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't make sense. If you've got a teacher, you can ask them questions. And I'm unfortunately not there for everyone to answer their individual questions. But what I've done is I've made a recording of me presenting the material from each new chapter in the same way in which I would present it if I was teaching you in a classroom. So that way, each student who's sitting, you know, somewhere on their own at home, as long as they have an internet connection, they basically have me presenting the material to them.
So it really does function in many ways like an online course. And there's a wealth of material at the website, actually YouTube videos and whatnot. So it's really a comprehensive resource for self-study.
I wanted to make it that way because I know that there are so many people who want to learn Sanskrit who either are not in the right place geographically or just don't have the time to take a regular Sanskrit course. Sanskrit, unfortunately, isn't taught in that many places in North America or in Europe. And my hope was that with this book and with all the online resources that go with it, you can get as close as possible to taking an actual Sanskrit course. One of the main difficulties I find when you teach yourself, which I remember from when I taught myself Sanskrit, is how to pace yourself. How to know when you've made enough progress for a day or for the week or something like that, which is why I also offer online courses where I do just that. So if you sign up, you know, you just sign up to a Google group. It's all free. You get weekly emails from me in which I then suggest this is a good portion of material to work on for over the course of this week. I assume you would need around 3 hours to complete the work. And here are the online resources that I've put up. Here are the relevant pages in the book. And then finally, here is the Facebook group that you can join to ask any questions that you might have about this week's material or about the material from past weeks and so on. And on that Facebook group, I answer whenever I can. But at this point, there's also quite a number of other students who then happily chime in and say, oh, no, I think it works like this, it works like that, and so on. So that was my attempt at providing a Sanskrit course that is accessible anywhere that you have an internet connection, basically.
No, it's a brilliant hybrid hybrid's maybe not the best word, but it's a textbook that it's a cross between a textbook and an online course. It seems it's
yeah,
both.
I think hybrid isn't such a bad word. I think that's quite apt. Yes, it's somewhere between the two. Or at least that was what my hope was. I love teaching Sanskrit in a classroom setting, and I do it as much as I can. But there's just a lot that you know that you cannot do. There are people, there's people who've learned Sanskrit with this book who are in Australia, and you know, I communicate with them as much as I can simply because it's fun. But there is just no way that we could get together in a classroom setting. And so to communicate with people. In the US, in Canada, in South America, I think at this point I've had students from every continent except Antarctica, as far as I know. So to be able to communicate with them in this way isn't ideal, but it sort of comes a close second, which makes me very happy.
It's actually, I had my own prejudices against online learning, but in 2016 I ended up founding an online academy where we looked at mythological stories. It was called Power of Myth at the time. It was an homage to Campbell's famous PBS mm-hmm. series. And I actually, it was transformative for me to understand how transformative online learning can be. And there are many classes after which you had to give yourself a shake because it wasn't obvious in the moment that you are on different continents. there's a sense of immediacy that for folks who have folks who were adults before the internet became so huge, it's counterintuitive to think that you can have such a palpable connection with someone in the moment who is hundreds of miles away.
And so often it comes with a picture, and the sound quality is good, and it doesn't, cost you that much, or it doesn't cost anything very often. It's rather wonderful, and I think as educators, as pedagogues, it's really important to see what new developments there are and make the best of them in the resources that we provide for our students. And I'm sure that what I've created is already, so 2017. So I'm always on the lookout for people who say, oh, there is this new platform, there is this new program, there's this new software. Wouldn't you consider creating something for that platform? I, from time to time, I do that. Sometimes I find that my students just do these things themselves, and then show to me what they've got. So it's wonderful.
Given that that this text evolved from, various student needs and various pedagogical needs over the course of years, it really is in many ways the textbook that we wish we had when we started out, which is the best. It's the best kind of product. This is how you develop a great product or solution, or what have. If I go give talks for alt-ac stuff or online learning or this or that, it's always a case where, what do I wish that someone told me when I started out, or someone provided? And so it's obviously has this organic intuitive feel, and given its online presence and the extent to which it lends itself to distance learning, I really think it's poised to change the way a lot of folks learn Sanskrit, or maybe grant access to Sanskrit. I want to ask, as maybe we've taken a fair bit of your time for today, so we'll close shortly, but perhaps you can share with our listeners two thoughts come to mind. Share with them, so who should learn Sanskrit? Obviously people interested in Hinduism or Hindu texts, Hindu Sanskrit texts in some way, but it's more than that. And in your perspective, much more than my training shows, that it's much more than people who want to learn specifically about Hindu texts. So who should learn Sanskrit? And what's your advice to them in terms of how to learn the language?
Right. I think there are many different reasons for why someone might want to learn Sanskrit. Obviously, if you are interested in anything relating to India, it doesn't just have to be Hinduism, which of course is a very big part of Indian culture and Indian everyday life, but anything to do with India, with Indian history, Indian thought, Indian philosophies. Sanskrit is the language that will grant you access to all of the texts in which the seminal thoughts are contained. So if you have an interest in anything India related in particular, then Sanskrit is the way to go. However, I think that Sanskrit is such a source of beauty and of wisdom that even for people who, up to this point weren't particularly interested in India or didn't know anything about it, have never been there, they might still enjoy it very much, because it is a language. Well, going back to what you were saying earlier, the very systematic character of the language. In Sanskrit, many linguistic features are available are clearly visible and are used regularly, that in other languages are there only in traces or in sort of irregular forms. So, for example, if you want to learn ancient Greek, there is this thing called my verbs, which gives great headaches to any student who first attempts understanding them. But I remember I once had students who were trying to understand them, and I said, "Oh, but it's easy. You already know Sanskrit. in Sanskrit, we just basically call them, you know, we call them athematic verbs, and you've had lots and lots of experience with them. So, you know, here you go. It's really straightforward. You already know this thing from Greek. You already know this from Sanskrit. In Sanskrit, you've got a very active, what some call subjunctive, some call optative, but it's very similar to the English subjunctive, which we have only in small fragments. And to understand what a subjunctive is on the basis of English is really, really difficult. In Sanskrit, it's there systematically, so it's easy to understand what a subjunctive or optative, however you want to call it, what it might be doing. If you look at this idea of case endings or of case, which is something that you've got in many languages, in English, you've got traces of it. In French, in German, in so many other languages, you've got traces of it. If you see how it works in Sanskrit, it's very easy to understand because it's there, it's systematic, it's visible, it's omnipresent. And so from a linguistic point of view, Sanskrit is an excellent language to help you understand other languages that you might be learning. Now that's the linguistic point of view. But Sanskrit isn't just a language, it's a language that is used in lots and lots of very important and or very beautiful texts. And if you learn a language such as Latin or ancient Greek, which I greatly recommend, these are wonderful too. But if you learn a language such as those, then you have access to the literature of a specific time period of maybe, you know, just a few centuries. With Sanskrit, given its history, where it was basically fixed in time, frozen in time by the grammarian Panini in around the 5th century BC, you have close to 2,500 years of literature written over a huge area, basically the entire Indian subcontinent, that are accessible to you if you have understood these grammatical rules, if you know these grammatical forms and so on. So the amount of material that you have access to, that is incomparable. And if you are from a culture, you know, not from India, but if you are, for example, from Europe or from the Americas, then seeing Sanskrit, seeing Indian thought expressed in Sanskrit is something that shows you, for example, what is pan-human and what is culture-specific. And you see that so many of our hopes, of our fears, of the things that we love, of the things that make us happy, of things that are precious to us, are the same, the entire world over. And I find that is just something extremely, extremely beautiful and satisfying to see that these people who are from a completely different time, from a completely different place, are basically, you know, sort of kin. They're basically family. They have the same things that move them, the same things that concern them. And when you find that you can just engage with these minds so intimately, so closely, then being racist or being bigoted in any way becomes really quite difficult, I find.
What an inspiring and eloquent response in terms of all that can be afforded through the study of Sanskrit. Now, for one starting off, they'll obviously have an excellent tool in this Cambridge introduction of yours and access to online resources and an online community above and beyond the various tips that you present in your book and the material. Mm. Do you have any advice for someone starting off?
Yes, I would say the most important thing is not to expect perfection right away. So when we learn something, something very, very small, very simple, it's wonderful if we can make, you know, very clearly visible progress in one day. With learning a language, that's you basically having a go at something that is fairly huge, that is fairly intricate, that has many, many different facets. So when you learn anything complex, or in this case specifically a language, focus on the steps that you've already taken. So for example, if you start by learning the script that Sanskrit is customarily written in, the Devanagari, then set yourself a goal such as, today I want to learn 10 characters. And then once you know those 10 characters, and maybe the day later you come back and you immediately recognize, oh yeah, that's the letter A, that's the letter Ta, or something like that, then, you know, that is something to enjoy, to be proud of, to be rightly proud of. I always tell my students, you know, to pat themselves on their shoulders once they've done something, rather than focus on the bits that they don't know yet. Because with anything complex, the bits they don't know yet are usually quite many and quite manifold. And so set yourself small goals, rejoice in reaching those small goals, and don't feel that you need to achieve perfection. Just focus on making progress. A little bit of progress on a regular basis is much better than sitting down to a mammoth session of working on your Sanskrit knowledge for 3 hours all in one go, because then you'll probably be a little bit daunted by the the idea that you might have to spend, you know, 3 hours on Sanskrit next time you sit down. No, just do things for 10 minutes, for 15 minutes. If you have a commute where you're using public transport, use your flashcards on public transport. If you're taking a shower and you're letting your thoughts wander, then maybe recite a paradigm or two. Just little bits, and you'll make progress. Focus on the progress and not on anything that you might not know yet. And before you know it, things that might seem unsurmountable or might have seemed unsurmountable 2-3 months ago, all of a sudden you'll see that, oh, I know these things. And that's something that I say to my students in class. But in class, I am there to remind them of that on a daily basis. When you're studying these things on your own, you don't have me there to say that to you and to praise you for what you've done. So praise yourself. Be positive.
That sage advice deeply resonates. There are many of us who have been using Sanskrit texts for years, and we may not be able to read without a dictionary, for example. That would be a feat for most of us in the Western world. It would be an absolute feat to be able to read Sanskrit, even with a command of the grammar, and have sufficient vocabulary to span 3,000 years of usage. There are many of us who, give me a Purana or an epic, and that's great. And if you point me towards Vedic Sanskrit, I you know, it's all Greek to me, as they say. It's such useful advice, because it's so easy for us to say, what do I know? I mean, I would never, for example, presume to apply to a Sanskrit position at a university to teach it. And yet, if I'm tutoring somebody, we're amazed at actually how much we do know, and that we forget how much we know, because we're struggling to strive after all that we lack. And it's so ironic. This language is called Samskrita, well made or perfected, and yet it takes the language itself is a perfected language, but it takes such a long time to practice towards mastering that perfection. I really like the idea that you mention and you allude to, that this is an organic process. This is a marathon. This is, one needs to live in and live with the language for some time to really make lasting progress. It's not such that you can have downloads once a week for 2-3 hours. It's very much an organic process. The last thing that comes to mind is something that occurred to me throughout the thought that I've had before, but it hit me throughout our conversation, that languages are mindsets. And to really learn Sanskrit is to really and truly establish a sort of mental training that affords you a worldview that is, I would say, richer, but perhaps that's subjective, but definitely more vast than the worldview you'd have in your original language.
Absolutely.
Would you feel the same way?
Yes. There are just... I find that with each language that you learn and that you're able to either read, or for modern languages that you're able to communicate in, there are just so many more thoughts that become accessible to you, because you are able to read what other people say, what other people think. You are able to hear from people who are from a different background, from a different society than you. And you might be able to access these theoretically if you read about them in translation in a book somewhere. But when you sort of see them lived, that's just a completely different experience, and that's something that moves you, and that you remember a lot more easily. Plus, on the very basic literal level, knowing a language allows you to read the text in that language, allows you to encounter them without any kind of mediator, without a translator or something like that. It's you and the text, it's you and the person who composed this text, whether that was 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, or perhaps even longer than that.
Now, for anyone who is considering starting to learn Sanskrit or brushing up on Sanskrit, I personally, based on my own resonance with it, or having looked it over, I highly recommend you taking a look at the Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit. We have, of course, been speaking with its author, Dr. Antonia Rupel of Oxford, the University of Oxford. She's in the Linguistics, Philology, and Phonetics department. Thank you very much for your time today. It's been a fascinating interview.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
All right. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, keep reading. Take care and see you soon.